All right. Well, welcome back to Sheep Stuff You Should Know, the world famous sheep podcast, or at least famous in our own minds. I'm Dan Makin. I am a livestock and natural resources advisor with UC Cooperative Extension in the Sierra Foothills. And today I am joined by Dr. Leslie Roach, who is on the Davis campus. Hi, Leslie. How are you?
Hey, Dan. I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I wanted to start by asking you just to give our listeners a little bit of your background. Who are you and where did you come from and what do you do now?
Who am I?
Who are you today?
Who am I today? So I am a professor of cooperative extension in rangeland management. So I'm with cooperative extension. I'm based out of UC Davis, but my appointment is, for the state of California through University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources, or ANR. And where did I come from? I guess originally, so I grew up on a small family ranch, small multi-generational family ranch, right kind of in between Tulare and Fresno counties. And kind of from there, ended up here, I guess, in a nutshell.
And you, and was it cow-calf, the operation?
Yes, cow-calf, yes.
Okay,
yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And, please forgive me.
Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. So it was up in the foothills, wasn't it?
Yes. So actually, it was this really horribly ugly place outside the Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park.
Oh, awful. Horrible place to grow up. And you grew up doing 4-H and FFA, is that right?
Actually, no, I was in such a small town, we didn't have 4-H, but I did in high school. I was very active in FFA. And actually, through the FFA, I got an internship with Cooperative Extension, and that was the first time I'd ever heard of Cooperative Extension. It was actually in tomatoes, so very different, but it was with an agricultural researcher, and that's kind of how I dipped my toe in the Cooperative Extension pond, and kind of went from there, pulling together my different interests and landing here at Davis in range in Cooperative Extension.
How did you get interested in range? It seems like something that we don't hear very much about when we're kids, unless we grow up around it. What got you focused on rangelands?
Well, so like every young girl between the ages of 8 and 18, I wanted to be a veterinarian. And of course, I grew up on a ranch and had a lot of firsthand experience. And then quickly realizing, probably later than I should have, that my intense fear of needles wasn't going to make that a no-go. So I actually started at Davis as an animal science major, but trying to figure out what I really wanted to do. And I think, again, like most kids, kind of resisting what we grew up around initially, I eventually just kind of came back to it and realized that I really loved working on the rangeland side of things and on issues related to sustainability. Sustainability was like the big buzzword when I was in high school. It was kind of our regenerative agriculture back then. And so there was a lot of heated debate around the word sustainability back then, but I was really drawn to it. And particularly in terms of rangeland stewardship. And so it's kind of how I eventually, I had to come back to it on my own terms, I guess.
That sounds like some other people I know in my family. That
I was actually just thinking about them.
Kind of started out the same way. Never know where that seed will sprout, right? So, as an extension specialist, you don't teach traditional college classes, but you do extension work and research focused around rangelands. Is that right?
Yeah, I think I like to explain it as like as extension specialists are teaching, it's like out in the communities. And it's not like teaching one directional, not that actually that, we don't even have one directional teaching on campus anymore. It's more like this multi-directional learning. And so that's kind of how I like to frame it is, you know, our teaching component, it's really out in the communities. But we also bring a lot of that back to campus too. I, particularly in the spring, our most busiest time, I get a lot of requests, as I know you do too, provide lectures and teaching on campus through a lot of different classes. And so we bring, I really like that part because we can bring the range, you know, back into a lot of these other classes. Like you were saying, you know, growing up, you don't hear a lot about range. And actually at UC Davis, we didn't really used to hear a lot about range either because we, you know, had a pretty small number of folks here on campus that are really focused in range, but that's, you know, that's quickly changing as we get some new hires, and there's a lot of folks interested in rangelands because they are all around us.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're this unique intersection of kind of natural landscapes and economic activity, aesthetics, and there's so much diversity and opportunity to work in rangelands in California in particular, it seems like, that it's cool to see it coming back on campus too.
Yeah. And I use it as a, you know, one of the examples of kind of, you know, in the rangeland discipline, we've kind of been on the leading edge of, you know, that intersection of the agricultural, environmental, and social issues of working landscapes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, students and a lot of my colleagues that work in more, our colleagues that work in more intensive agricultural production systems, they, you know, I've used kind of our work and the things that we've been doing as kind of examples of how you deal with some of these often contentious intersections that they, you know, are dealing with as well now.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So what kinds of things are you interested in from a research perspective, just broadly? Where are the areas that you're focusing your efforts right now?
So the state of California, no. So my programs, you know, I really always kind of think of them together, research and extension, as, you know, directly integrated, and as I know a lot of us in extension do, and really thinking about, you know, in my programs, targeting those critical issues, like we just said, that are at the intersection of agricultural environment, as well as social aspects of ranching and livestock production. And over the last, I started this position actually almost nine years ago. And kind of some of the big research questions that we've been focusing on are with, you know, through the lens of thinking as of rangelands as social ecological systems. And so a big one, as you know, has been ranching and rangeland resilience to drought. And then as an extension of that, climate change.
Yeah.
And then kind of the second big theme has been, and this is like a huge bucket for a theme, is managing for ecosystem services, or the, you know, kind of we think of them as like the benefits to humankind on California's working rangelands. And then, of course, weaved into all of that is thinking about, you know, how we connect that solution-oriented research with the needs of stakeholders and a growing diversity of stakeholders, and thinking in particular about kind of how do we directly engage them through either, you know, participatory research or needs assessments, you know, multiple avenues.
Yeah. Well, along those lines, I want to dig in a little deeper in some of the research that you've done on campus, looking at native range plant restoration, native grass restoration, and kind of the tools that we have available to manage them. And that's specifically talking a little bit about sheep too, but maybe an overview of the project that you took over on campus and kind of what that research is demonstrating.
Yeah. So, about when I started about a decade ago, there was this really interesting opportunity. So a lot of the work that we do is on ranch and on ranches across California. So I don't do like a lot of my colleagues on campus. I don't do a ton, or I haven't done a ton of work on the university farm. But there was this opportunity where we had some senior colleagues who have since left now, retired and moved on, that they had established this really interesting native grassland restoration. It was about a 12-acre site on the university farm. And it was really interesting because it had been, when I started, it was about 4 years old. And basically they were looking at just plowing it under. Yeah. And another colleague of mine and I were thinking about, wow, it's such a great opportunity. It's this 4-year-old successful restoration site. It would be such a shame to see that go, you know, to lose that. And because there's so much opportunities for layering on a lot of questions, because there is, you know, given that California is a predominantly transformed, invaded non-native system, and native restoration is so hard and so often does fail and it's so expensive. This was a really unique on-campus opportunity to you know, look at some longer term questions. And so we took over this project, and the sort of the initial setup of this project was just looking at, you know, is there a way to strategically seed these very expensive native grass seeds in a way that you wouldn't have to seed an entire site? Could you just feed, you know, a third of that site or half of that site, mm-hmm. and save those associated costs, but potentially end up with the same outcomes? And so this is, you know, the strategy here, it's called strip seeding. And basically it produces alternating rows. So these are drill seeded, native plant seeds. So producing alternating rows of seeded and unseeded areas. And when we took this over, like I said, it was about four years old at the time. And, we actually ended up, pulling together, the data on this and finding that, yeah, over time, as little as 4 years, seeding as little as 33% of a site provided the same, you know, native plant productivity and cover benefits as seeding 100% of the site. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that adds up to quite a bit of cost savings, yeah. Compared to that conventional seeding. And so that was really cool. That was great. But the thing was, is the way they were managing this plot when we took it over was they were just mowing it every year. and as you can imagine, so that's just it was logistically easy on prime agricultural farmland, farmland, but that's just not something that's feasible out on rangeland. And so and I specifically, of course, was interested in layering over or stacking some of these other targeted practices we could use and answering some of these questions of how do we manage for multiple ecosystem services, you know, in these restored sites. And so we immediately shut down mowing and started introducing targeted sheep grazing, using sheep from the UC Davis Animal Science Farm, as well as we started layering in small-scale prescribed burning to see if we could manage, you know, that vegetation for some multiple objectives that we had set.
And I just want to interject, I believe was 2016, or 17, the first year you grazed?
Ooh, yeah, 17. Let's see. I think it was 17, yes.
And to my knowledge, that was the first time that the UC Davis sheep had been off the sheep unit.
It was.
Since I was in college back in the 80s. So.
Yeah, it was.
What a novel concept. You can actually take sheep through the grass.
Well, and it was the coming together of some just fortunate events that made that happen. You know, we were really interested in bringing the sheep on. The sheep barn had a new manager who was really interested in not feeding sheep. And so we were able to work it out that we could take over the sheep for you know, about a week for targeted grazing. And they were very happy with that. And that's continued. So we have done that every year since 2017. And really, you know, this is targeted sheep grazing. So, you know, they're only out there for about a week. And we specifically set some objectives of, you know, we wanted to hit about a 50% use goal. And one of the things we wanted to do was look at not just managing the native grass, but also managing a invasive annual grass, Medusa head, that we, funny enough, we actually had to introduce Medusa head to these plots because it wasn't an agricultural field. We didn't have you know, naturalized population there. So a little bit, also a little bit of a funny thing that we don't typically have to do out on rangeland is introduce an invasive.
It's there on its own. Yeah.
It made some of my research neighbors a little nervous. So we did that, and you know, we were looking at timing the sheep grazing so that we could hit the majority of that Medusa head in the early flowering phase.
Okay.
So that we could get effective control of, you know, the best effective control we could get on that. And then after that first year of grazing, we introduced those small scale, like 1 meter square burning treatments to see how the interaction of grazing and burning could be used to manage native as well as that invasive grass.
And are you using fire on its own or on top of the grazing or kind of both?
All combinations. Yep.
Okay.
So So we have there's four blocks of these strip seeding treatments, and two of those blocks we grazed and two we have left ungrazed since 2017.
Okay.
So you can imagine what they look like. And and then where we seeded in that invasive annual Medusa head, we layered on burning treatments in both the grazed and the ungrazed, and then looked at it in, you know, we also had areas where we had seeded Medusa head and areas where we had not seeded Medusa head for controls.
Yeah.
And so what we found so far, as you can imagine, this has generated a ton of data that we're still processing.
Yeah.
But what we found so far is that the grazing and burning treatments were both effective in reducing that Medusa head. So they work, but there's some trade-offs, particularly for some of the individual native species that are less tolerant of heavy grazing. You know, we were aiming for that 50% use overall in the plot, but as you know, there's always some areas that get a little heavier use than others. And so we have seen some decline in cover of some of the native species, but they're still holding. And, you know, on the flip side, in those ungrazed plots, kind of the trade-off we've seen is that, so we have this buildup of that old dead material from those native perennial grasses, that residual material.
Yeah.
And so lots of fine fuels. And when we went in and did those burn plots, you know, not surprisingly, they burned a lot hotter. And so we have actually seen an increase in perennial grass loss in those ungrazed burn plots because they did burn hotter and they did kill those plants off.
Because of the greater intensity of the burn.
Yeah. Yep, because of that. Yep, those hotter burns.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the trade-off there of just using burning, you know, particularly after fuels have built up. And now what we're kind of the next step of what we just got some funding to do was to look at, well, what about, so that's using burning and grazing as a tool. What about just in thinking about fire as wildfire and changing wildfire frequencies? You know, are we going to see larger, more frequent fires? How might these systems respond to that versus, you know, less frequent fire? And so we've actually been layering on more burning treatments to look at, you know, one burn every 5 years up to four burns every 5 years.
Yeah.
See how that impacts biodiversity, productivity, and soil health. So more looking at it in a more nuanced way than just, oh, if this burned after, you know, two or three years of no burn conditions. Okay, sure, it burns hotter. But what if it was burning like every year or every other year? What are the impacts?
Yeah.
And not just to biodiversity and productivity, but we're also starting to look underground. So looking at soil health, looking at the microbiome, carbon sequestration, and really digging in to how these stack practices influence soil health. And I say digging in like as much as I possibly can when I talk to my soil scientist friends.
You know, I want to back up here just a second because I realize as we're talking that a lot of my sheep friends refer to anything that's not irrigated as native pasture.
Mm-hmm.
We all mean a little different, something a little different by native. So native in this case is plants that are native to California. Is that right?
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. And so these are, actually those, and these are those native plants that we knew were here, you know, like pre-contact.
Yeah.
And we don't, you know, we don't have a complete picture of what California grasslands really looked like pre-contact. Actually, it might be that they were more forblands instead of grasslands. So there might have been a lot more native broadleaf plants.
Okay.
And that's kind of what some of the research has been pointing to, but we don't have a perfect picture of what it originally looked like and what is original, what is, you know, how far do we go back? But there, you know, we do know we have some of these native grass species that are kind of the flagships, like purple needle grass or sempervipera. That's actually our state grass. Or Elymas glaucus. And we actually the native grasses that were selected for the strip seeding, I think we had seven native perennials, one native annual, and they were kind of those species were selected because they're kind of the dominant ones that are most used in restoration. So these are, you know, the species that restoration practitioners typically ask about. If we could go back in time, it would have been great to also introduce or seed some of those, lesser well-known and maybe some of those native forb species as well, to get a better mix. And that's actually kind of what we were thinking of for next steps as we are developing proposals to maybe launch a similar type of project off the farm onto rangeland, I guess, native rangeland. naturalized rangeland.
right. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the other question. Why should I, as a sheep grazer, be concerned about native versus introduced species? Are there some benefits from a kind of a production standpoint to having more of these native perennials on rangeland?
So what we're finding with these, when it works, it works. And the native perennials, once they are established, they are, you know, pretty resistant to invasion by those annual grasses. Mm-hmm. You got to get them established, but they are pretty resilient. Also, they are greener into the summer later.
Right.
And so there's been some work looking at forage quality. Obviously, once like Stipa, for example, gets those long awns, particularly sheep are less impressed by them right there at eye level. Yeah. But there are some benefits of having that greener forage later into the season. Some of these species are really good also in the early season in terms of forage quality. So it's kind of diversifying your forage portfolio in a way. And then also just thinking about, you know, that's the from the sheep production side, but thinking from the restoration side and using sheep as a tool, there's a lot of restoration practitioners and other land managers that, you know, their objective is to have a native grassland on the land that they manage. And in the very beginning of this project, there were a lot of questions about, well, how do we bring, you know, how can we use grazing as a tool, or should we even introduce grazing at all, or should we just leave it alone and not touch it? And already we're showing what happens when you leave it alone and don't touch it. You create these, you know, huge fire fuel conditions. Yeah. And then you could lose everything.
Yeah. 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 And I think that's the other interesting piece of it too, that those of us kind of out on the landscape know, but sometimes it gets lost in translation, is what targeted grazing actually does in terms of fuels management. It's not a fire break. It's not, we're not taking things down to bare ground, but we're changing the intensity of the fire when it comes across the landscape. And it's interesting to put some numbers to that reduction in intensity, I think, too.
Yeah. Well, it's like you said, you know, a lot of these things we find out and we produce these scientific papers and we're so proud of ourselves. And the practitioners are like, yeah, we knew that.
Yeah.
It's like, no, that's awesome. I actually love that because great, we did science and it confirms what we heard from folks say that works, but now we have it documented in a systematic way. That's actually the strip seeding. When we published that first paper out of the strip seeding project, I think I tweeted it and a restoration practitioner immediately was like, oh yeah, we've known this for years. We've been doing this for a long time. And we knew about that. We knew it had worked in different systems, but there wasn't this, this long-term documentation of it, you know, for a rangeland type setting. And so I think it's great when people say, well, we knew that. That works.
that's why we do what we do, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that strikes me as interesting in this conversation is how grazing can be a positive tool and potentially a problematic tool Is there some evidence that the introduction of domestic livestock, including sheep, when the first Europeans came to California, resulted in that big transition to introduced annual rangeland?
Yeah, there were a lot of things that happened during that period that all kind of unfortunately set up perfect conditions for the takeover of California of the non-natives. And so, you know, there was a lot of really heavy use of the landscape, not just in terms of grazing, but just agricultural intensification as well. And so a lot of degradation that way. There was a lot, you know, of course, then the introduction of those invasive, of those non-native species that we now have come to accept, coming over in ships' ballast, you know, all kinds of ways. And then really intense drought.
Right.
And so kind of all of these big disturbances clashing together at once provided these conditions. And of course, within the Mediterranean climate, where a lot of these species came from and were well adapted to our Mediterranean climate, they were able to flourish because, you know, the annual species strategy is to get out, get up, make seed, and then get out of there. Just get your seed out and get out of there. And you know, with our you know, annual summer dry period, that just is works. They're very well adapted to that, to get their seed out, and then we enter what we call, I guess, our summer dormant period, or our typical summer no water period.
Yeah.
And so they're able to take advantage of that because they were pre-adapted to it. And so there's that really early, overgrazing conditions. I mean, we all know grazing is not grazing. And we know, the bad things that, you know, poor management can do, and can contribute to.
And on the flip side of that, good management.
Yep.
Can make it a really effective tool for accomplishing some of these other, as you said, ecosystem services too.
Yeah. Yep. So yeah, exactly. All grazing is not equal, just like all fire is not equal.
Yeah,
and we don't have to throw the entire tool out because it can be used the wrong way. And thinking about, you know, and adapting our management, what is the right tool? You can't always use a hammer. If you only ever use a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail to you, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I want to turn now to kind of some emerging issues that you see relative to rangelands in California and maybe small ruminants in particular, since this is a sheep podcast. But but what are some of the areas that you think you'll be focusing on and will be focusing on in extension in the coming decade?
So I think we'll continue to think about how we can adapt to and cope with drought and increasing intensity and frequency of drought.
Yeah.
As the climate changes. And so that's something that is kind of always there. And I think you're the one that always says the best time to think about drought is when it's raining. So even now we should be thinking about drought and really just thinking about, you know, how do we help a whole range of folks adapt to that? And how do we learn from the folks that have been, you know, working on these lands, how, you know, what they have learned from previous experiences and how we can, you know, help that to inform our future. One of the things that, you know, as you know, we've been doing quite a bit of social survey and interviews over the last, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
With ranchers in particular, but also rangeland managers. And a lot of that early work, we really learned a lot about drivers of individual adaptive capacity and what folks were doing to cope with drought. And, you know, some of that, the most recent work we've used was that, you know, coming out of California's, our last exceptional statewide drought, so 2012 to 2016, we were able to kind of look at how folks, you know, how that historic drought had shaped the impact, you know, impacts and management strategies, and how folks were kind of changing their perspectives and practices and thinking about the future. And really, you know, which was really striking to me, was when we did those early surveys back, I think, in 2010, there wasn't a whole lot of mention about proactive drought planning as there was about, you know, the things people do in response once a drought has hit.
Yeah.
But during that last severe drought, which actually was, before 2012, there was quite a few pretty significant regional droughts for people across the state, particularly in Southern California. We found that people had really increased their use of proactive practices during that exceptional drought and before it as well. And we're doing a lot more proactive drought planning.
What's an example of proactive? Yeah.
So thinking, you know, some of the things that we found that folks were doing a lot of during that historic drought was, you know, setting conservative stocking rates. So thinking about what are the number of animals that I can have on a unit of land that I can still sustain even if a drought hits. Or thinking about, okay, if the drought hits, thinking ahead of time, what are some animals I know I need to think about selling? Or, you know, what are some pastures that I can kind of save and rest right now and use if the upcoming season is drier or is hit by drought? So kind of that, you know, thinking about what are things that I might be able to enact or do if a drought were to hit, as opposed to droughts hit, I need to start buying hay, I need to start, applying for disaster assistance or just immediately trying to reduce herd size without any of that forward planning. One of the things that came out was really interesting was one of the proactive practices that, I lost my earbud here. Okay. I talk with my hands. I think I just hit my earbud out. One of the things that really popped out, as you know, was, one of the least very least used proactive practice was multi-species grazing. So using both sheep and cattle within a single operation, having these different enterprises and goats as well. And it was the least used, but it was like off the charts in terms of how folks ranked it in terms of effectiveness for coping with and managing drought. And I remember that really sticking out as kind of a surprise. There was a small group of folks that were using it in particular for proactive drought planning, but for them and their experience, it was really, really effective. And we also found those folks had like a kind of a bigger toolbox of other practices they were using as well. So potentially this was feeding into that, giving them flexibility. And so this is something that I know quite a few of us have been really interested in kind of following that thread and looking into, you know, how operations might structure or restructure to improve long-term sustainability. This is as you can imagine, it's a big deal to kind of change or add a whole new enterprise because we all have endless amounts of time. But it was really interesting in that, you know, these folks did have significantly more flexibility than their single species operator, you know, counterparts to cope with and adapt to drought. So really diversifying their ranching portfolio.
Is there something inherently more flexible or adaptable about small ruminants compared to cattle? And I speak as somebody that works with all kinds of producers, but just curious as to your take on that.
I was gonna tease you a second, be like, no, absolutely not.
You can tease me. People expect it on this podcast.
I think it opens up other opportunities. We did see that those operations with sheep and goats integrated into their operation have had more forage resources that they could flex between in their operations and use, you know, things like crop aftermath. Just the ability to, you know, use more non-permanent mobile fencing with sheep, it just increases that flexibility than you can with cattle. I think, with the advent of some of these new rangeland technologies that might even the playing field a little bit more, but I think still you're just going to be able to go more places with sheep. You always will be able to. We would love to bring cattle out onto those strip seed plots at the farm, but it's only 12 acres.
Right.
And yeah, and even if we did have all the latest virtual fencing technology, I would not want a cow out on Russell Boulevard in Davis. I don't want a sheep out there either, but at least I can stop a sheep by myself.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I'm one of the things that was really really interesting as we had wolves come back into the Northern Sierra. Mm-hmm. You know, the system for operating in the high country with sheep involves a herder being with the band of sheep. There's somebody mm-hmm. with them 24/7. And that's not the model that we've used on the cattle side of public lands grazing for a long mm-hmm. time. I called permittees when we had a transitory wolf come through the Tahoe National Forest, and the cattle permittees were understandably very, very concerned. And the sheep permittees were like, well, guess that's something else that might want to eat sheep. I'll tell the herders to be on a lookout. And mm-hmm. it was like there was some flexibility just because of the management system inherent with sheep that was difficult on the cattle side of things. Just having somebody there all the time was not an option on cattle permits.
Yeah, I mean, they're working from very different baselines.
Right.
And already, yeah, like you said, they're just, yep, something else is going to try to eat my sheep.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think, yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just thinking, you know, you're saying what other threads, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, multi-species grazing and thinking about range-on technology. It's also kind of also feeds into some of the new work around what, you know, the space we're calling climate smart ag. And just thinking about, you know, what are the various practices or strategies that folks can use to, you know, increase not just productivity or resilience of their operations and of the land, to things like increasing drought and climate change. And, you know, how can people adapt and build resilience and not just you know, ecological, but also social. I mean, what you just brought up is a great example of just sort of different social contexts as well between those operations. And so also kind of thinking how this all feeds into, you know, what we're calling today climate smart ag, and thinking about, you know, how do we take the things that folks are doing and thinking about adapting to climate change in a more positive way. Thinking about, and I'm thinking like, you know, more carrots, less sticks type of approach.
Yeah.
Right, because a lot of things that we learn when we ask folks about climate change and drought, was, you know, folks, you know, are really interested in learning about climate change and the impacts on their operations. And they do see it as, you know, important to the future of their operation. But I mean, not surprisingly, I know you know this, the biggest thing that they're worried about related to climate change is the changing rules and regulations that come with it.
Yeah.
And from the, you know, the government, governmental side and planning side. And so I think climate smart ag is a nice way to kind of positively reframe things and think about the things that folks are doing or can do to help their operations in terms of, you know, not just resilience to climate change, but also enhancing productivity.
Well, and I think your experiment on the school farm is kind of a microcosm of that. You can burn fossil fuel and mow.
Yeah.
Or, you know, one day my dream is to walk the sheep from the sheep unit on mm-hmm. the on campus over to the experiment site. But you can either use fossil fuel and run a tractor to mow that site, or you can bring animals in that convert that vegetation into fiber and muscle and fat. It's a different system.
And it's a lot more fun to watch sheep than to watch a mower.
Yes, it is. Very definitely. Well, the last question I've got for you is a little more philosophical. You and I are both active. You're very active in the Society for Range Management. You're on the International Society board, right?
Yes. Yes, I am.
And I, you know, it, This is probably my own bias, but it does seem that from a professional standpoint, we in range are very focused on cattle as the tool by which we typically manage rangelands if we're managing them for multiple purposes. That maybe the flexibility of small ruminants and their ability to do things like graze crop aftermath and those types of things have kind of resulted in us forgetting that they're grazing animals too. Is that changing? Is that just the sheep guy being ticked off when he comes to the meeting and having to listen to cattle talk after cattle talk? Or are we starting to again embrace small ruminants as a tool within the larger rangeland management and science context?
I think absolutely. I think there has been kind of this resurging interest or renaissance in thinking about bringing in sheep and goats too, small ruminants, into these production systems, kind of like the multi-species grazing I mentioned. But, thinking, and particularly from thinking about them as, another tool on the landscape, from the restoration side and the fuels management side. I mean, as you well know, in California, just fuels management, there's so much interest in that now. Folks from all walks of life are thinking about wildfire now, unfortunately, fortunately. And so I think, there's a huge interest in thinking about, all the different practices or strategies that we can use for that, societal benefit. And I think, that's just propagated up in SRM as well. And really thinking about, in upcoming 2026, it will be the UN designated International Year of Pastoralists and Rangelands. And so, thinking from a global perspective, I know, obviously, California is a cow-calf state, but, from a global perspective, we've got all kinds of folks working with different species to manage these lands around the world. And so from the Society of Range Management perspective and thinking about it, as an international society, we can't just have one hammer or else all we see is nails.
Absolutely. And it's been interesting. It was interesting just coming back from the meeting up in Sparks, the SRM meeting up in Sparks, that there were talks that were focusing on small ruminants and on systems for managing small ruminants. And it's interesting to see our profession kind of re-engage in that. I sent you half jokingly a page out of a book yesterday or the day before about kind of the history of public lands grazing. And certainly there were a lot of sheep operations that had no home base that just took advantage of whatever grass they could put sheep on. And that really changed in terms of federal lands management in the 30s and 40s. Have we gone too far past that point to have viable sheep operations that can deal with fuels management on federal lands? Or do you think that's an opportunity for new producers to really look at seriously?
I mean, I hope we haven't gone too far past, because when we're thinking about the agricultural community and particularly ranchers, we have an aging demographic. We have, a lot of folks aren't, we're losing multi-generational operations. I'm one of those, from the generation that didn't go back to the ranch. And so, if we want to think about supporting new folks, first generation ranchers, beginning ranchers that, want to start operations, I think just thinking from a capital perspective and just, the resources they have available to them, a lot of these younger, newer, early career producers, they can get into, sheep and goat operations, more easily than you can a cattle operation, just in terms of, the resources that you need to sustain each.
They're gateway livestock.
Gateway livestock, yes. They're gateway livestock. But yeah, I mean, I think it would be a terrible loss of an opportunity if folks weren't able to do that. And then, of course, we'd be losing all those other benefits like fuels management, keeping, these, I guess, open spaces, where you want to call them, you know, keeping these, you know, these lands working and open. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of opportunities there because there is a, you know, declining population of folks that are doing this. And so how do we, you know, thinking about how do we sustain that? You need new people.
I'm always struck, excuse me, you mentioned this, but I'm always struck by how much place-based knowledge it takes to graze livestock well. Mm-hmm. And I would hate to lose that kind of place-based knowledge about the land and the landscapes that are what make up our rangelands too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that is also a future space for extension too, and bringing together, you know, these folks that are genuinely interested in getting into the business and those folks that are more experienced and genuinely interested in, sharing that experience with others.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's extension at its best is mm-hmm. people learn from one another. Yeah. So as we wrap up, if somebody were interested in learning more about your work at Davis, where would they find out what you're doing and what you're working on?
Well, they can go. We have our Research and Information Center online. So that's rangelands.ucdavis.edu. I share a little more quickly and more up-to-date information via our different social media platforms. So Facebook, X, formerly known as Twitter, and now Blue Sky. and that's, they can just search UC Rangelands. And then, of course, we have all our contact information out there, and they can reach out to folks. And, you know, we are a network of people, including you, of folks across the state. So, reaching out to their local county folks is also a great way to learn more about all the things that are going on. There's so many.
And to ask questions. I think that's the other cool thing about extension. If you're a producer and have a question about some particular issue on your ranch, your local extension people and specialists like you are a great resource too.
Yeah, absolutely. And when someone does have like a very specific local question, like on a particular pasture, the number one thing I do is connect them with their local person, because it's so difficult to answer something like that over the phone. Somebody's got to go out there and talk to them and get the context. And of course, you know, we also happy to do visits as well. But I mean, that's why there's local folks, so that we have that that connection, that community connection.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Leslie, thank you for talking sheep for almost a whole hour. You know, I could probably talk the rest of the day, but thank you. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It was fun. I like to talk about sheep. I know I come from a cattle background, but
see, we're just converting everybody one person.
I know.
It's part of a bigger plan. Well, this has been Sheep Stuff You Should Know. We'll talk to you all soon, and thanks for joining in. Thanks, Leslie.
Thanks, Dan.